You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. This is Edward Song, where I am an associate professor of philosophy at, I almost said Southwest Baptist University, at Westmont College. I've lost myself for a second. The chuckle in the background is Mr. Dr. Professor Coyle Neal, associate professor at the aforementioned Southwest Baptist University. How are you, Coyle?
I'm doing all right, Ed. I'm actually thinking about your good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Would it be better to listen to our podcast in the morning, afternoon, or evening? I don't see us being like a morning type thing. Like, you don't roll out of bed and think, I want to listen to Coyle Neal and Ed Song talk about political theory.
Yeah, I know, that's a hard question for me to answer.
Maybe if you're like a morning drinker.
How do you consume your podcasts? Let's go to the more general question.
So I try to do, if I'm listening to a religious podcast, I try to do that in the morning while I'm making breakfast for me and for the kid. Mm-hmm. And if I'm, if it's a non-religious podcast, on my walk to work or mowing the lawn, working in the shop, working around the house, those sorts of things. So it just depends.
Okay. I do the vast majority of my podcast listening on runs or while driving in my car, and I do not discriminate on the basis of content. And so, I would say I actually do most of my podcast listening in the morning. That's when I get it done. Though, yeah, I don't know. It's true. Starting your morning with a heavy dose of political theory might not necessarily be the best way for most people to start their days.
You and Jay Eldred need to get around to doing that running podcast.
I would be really interested. I've thought about a running podcast. Though actually these days I am doing so much less running that I don't know that I could do it authentically. Too many things going on.
Sure.
And so Coyle and I, we're revisiting the work of John Rawls, and this episode was occasioned by Coyle. Now, so you're rereading, you've been reading Justice's Fairness, John Rawls, Justice's Fairness, A Restatement, the work from John Rawls. Are you reading that for a class? Is that what that's about? Or
yeah, so I taught it this semester in an online political theory class,
which is
not really the ideal way to take a political theory class, but it's what they had. I've actually assigned it before, but the last time I assigned it, we didn't get to it in the semester, so I didn't finish reading it the last time. Took us so long on the other stuff we were covering, we only got through the first section. I don't even know if it was the whole first section.
Mm-hmm.
So this time I made it a point to be sure that there was time in the course, and actually have it all read myself. Which, is good to do if you're teaching a book, right?
You just have to be ahead of the students, Coyle.
Which is, I think I'm a little bit beyond that as a teacher now, at least I hope that I am. But certainly when I started, when I was taking classes and teaching at the same time, a little bit ahead of the students was, that was sort of the golden standard.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished reading this for the class.
Okay. And then Rawls forms the backbone of a lot of the way that I think about political theory. So Rawls is an important figure for me and for the kind of political philosophy that I do. So that is to say, political philosophers working in philosophy departments proper, Rawls is the locus classicus for any kind of contemporary political theorizing, like far and away the most dominant political theorist. And so it's occasioned by Coyle's teaching. I've actually been thinking about coming back to it. So I think in some ways you and I are probably at our best. We're both trained as theorists. And I think we are at our best when we're doing pretty straightforward political theory. And I mean, I don't know. It's been a while since we've done a pretty classic, straightforward political theory episode. And then I was just thinking, we launched this show way back when. I don't even know how many years has it been. 3 or 4 years or something?
It was early 2016. So spring of 2016.
Okay, so coming up to our 4-year anniversary. But yep. We launched our show with, I think, 2-part episodes, both on conservatism and liberalism or progressivism as political ideologies, where we were both doing, you know, pretty basic theorizing about the dominant political ideologies that frame our political discourse. And I think even when we did them, we had an idea that we would just sort of put those topics on a kind of a cycle and revisit them after some odd number of years. And I mean, I don't anticipate this being revisiting the topic for sure. I certainly don't want to just rehash what we talked about in the past. But I think in some ways this episode, and then we have a little bit of a corresponding episode planned for you all, looking at some new currents in very recent conservative political thought that we wanted to do. So in a way, this episode and the one that will come shortly thereafter are going to revisit some of these more fundamental topics in political theory. And so maybe we should just start with like just a really brief intro, and then I'll turn it over to you, Coyle, with your like impressions and questions from the book. But I mean, if listeners want to go back and get the full primer, you can go back to, I don't know, it'll be something like episode 3 or 4 from back in 2016, where we talked about all of this. But John Rawls is the now late political theorist. He died right around 2000, I think, a political theorist at Harvard who's famous for writing a book in 1971 called A Theory of Justice, in which he unpacked and defended a kind of a novel way of thinking about political justice. It is certainly a liberal or progressive take on things. And what's interesting about it is that he takes a very old classic approach to doing political theory, that is to say the method of the social contract, imagining political principles or political morality as arising out of a contract or agreement amongst people in a pre-political situation. He takes that classic view and kind of gives it a new twist. When it came out in the 70s, political theory in the Anglo-American world was a little bit more abundant. And so Rawls's book was like a big shot of adrenaline into the system, invigorating a lot of new debate. And again, what was interesting about it wasn't so much the conclusions, because Rawls is defending a very familiar progressive understanding about the importance of what I'm about to say is a little bit crude, but true enough. Defending the social welfare state. But what was interesting about his argument was the argument itself, the way in which he takes his classic argument and gives it a new twist in a very clever, creative, compelling, powerful kind of a way. So he articulates that theory in 1971. He famously defends two principles of justice. The first defends the kinds of familiar liberal political and civic liberties that we are familiar with. The second defends a pretty far-reaching standard of distributive justice that suggests that just regimes should distribute primary social goods like wealth so that they most benefit the most disadvantaged class. And again, what was clever about that whole argument is, about that whole theory is the argument itself. He sees that arising as a kind of agreement or social contract between persons. Though Rawls takes that idea of a social contract or agreement to a higher level of abstraction, and which is aims at modeling. It's a kind of a heuristic device that models certain intuitions that we have about the nature of justice. So he writes that in 1971. The theory undergoes some interesting developments and changes over the years, especially in the 80s and then kind of culminating in the early 90s with a book called Political Liberalism that continues to defend the conclusions of the theory, the two principles of justice, and the substantive arguments of the original theory, but kind of recasts the theory as a whole to try to address the problem of pluralism and diversity in political society. That is to say, how can we get people who have a variety of different conceptions about the good to agree on a single theory of justice, which is essential for any kind of stability in the kinds of pluralistic societies that we find in contemporary life. So that's my 3 or 4 or 5 minute little grand summary of the theory from 35,000 feet. Questions or disagreements or worries about that way of characterizing the theory?
No. I think that's a good summary. I would just add on that I'm not actually, I didn't cover any of those books or teach any of those books. I taught his final book, which is Justice as Fairness, and then subtitled A Restatement.
Yes.
Which is, at least according to the introduction, it's kind of a compendium of lecture notes from the last time he taught this course at Harvard, and then attempting to bring in some of what he saw as the most important criticisms of his work and then respond to them.
Yeah.
So it's I teach it primarily because it's about 300 pages shorter than Theory of Justice. And frankly, the less of Rawls's own words that you can read, the better, because he is not a good writer.
So I think, and, you know, I certainly said this in our earlier episodes, Rawls is the object of a tremendous amount of scorn from a certain kind of conservative political theorist. And then I would say, actually, especially amongst a certain kind of Christian conservative political theorist, for reasons that maybe we'll talk about later and maybe I'll end up defending later. I think one of the sources of that criticism actually arises out of misunderstandings and confusions as to what the theory is doing.
Sure.
Part of that has to do, I think, with the fact that, like, Rawls is a philosopher's philosopher. He is not interested in writing books for public consumption. Maybe he has interests in trying to move the public policy machinery in some ways, but he certainly isn't writing in any kind of direct way to influence those audiences. He is writing for a certain kind of academic political philosopher, not even political theorist in the broad sense, but again, for people operating within the very specific tradition of political philosophers working in philosophy departments in the Anglo-American world. And, you know, which is a discipline that's characterized by an extraordinary amount of attention to technical precision and rigor. So it can certainly seem confusing and weird and alien to people operating outside of that guild. And then the other thing that I'll say about the source of confusion gets at what you were saying earlier. So as I said, Rawls wrote the original book in 71. He revised the theory over the 80s and then kind of summarized those revisions in another big book that was published in the early 90s called Political Liberalism. Those two books together are, well over 1,000 pages. I mean, maybe it's closer to 2,000 pages than it is 1,000 pages, those two books.
Right.
And trying to understand how the new version of the theory adhered to the old version was generating, that by itself was generating a lot of confusion. To me, it's always interesting when a famous philosopher ends up changing his mind or modifying a theory in particular kind of ways. Like, that's always interesting and exciting. But then figuring out how the new theory is supposed to operate and connects to the old was a source of a lot of confusion. And so Justice as Fairness arose because Rawls had ended up, they're kind of lecture notes or crib notes that Rawls was writing for his graduate students to help explain to them in these graduate classes how the theory was meant to hold together. And so then actually after he died, those lecture notes or crib notes, like that kind of house version of the theory, ended up being published by by one of Rawls' students, like, edits it together. So it offers a kind of a nice, like, and it's a considerably shorter book. It's 200 pages, 202 pages without the index. And, you know, it offers something of a holistic explanation of the theory in general.
And it's much more manageable, I think, than for undergraduates, than Theory of Justice or Political Liberalism or even Law of Nations. I mean, even his international relations book, I think, are the size alone is intimidating. And throw in, again, like you said, he's not interested in dumbing this down. And his unique definitions.
Right? Yeah.
He'll use a term and then sort of give you five or six words on what the term means to him, and then he'll be off and running. And if you don't remember those five or six words, right, the book is just incomprehensible.
Yeah.
To be fair, Justice's Fairness is incomplete. He died before it was finished. So sort of maximum leniency there. I will stand on he's not a very good writer, but that's not to deny that he is a brilliant writer.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think I would actually disagree with that to a certain extent. I mean, I think it's incredibly well organized and built around the development of certain really core ideas. But he certainly isn't interested in trying to make them accessible for anyone who isn't a professional philosopher. And so it's like reading a scientific journal article. It's just, it's technical in a way that just makes it inaccessible. Even for people like you, like, it wasn't written for you as a political theorist who was trained in a political science department in kind of a slightly different kind of a tradition.
Sure.
You know, people might criticize Rawls for that, for writing something that's so narrow, and I don't know, maybe that's right, but it's certainly a technical, narrow book in its scope. But anyways, so what about the book jumped out to you, or interested you, or angered you, or what did you have questions about?
Well, I don't know that any of it angered me. As with most works of philosophy, at least most of the good works of philosophy, 80% of it, when you're reading, you're like, yeah, this is fine, right? I mean, most of it and that's going to be true of Aristotle or Machiavelli or whoever. Most of the time, through most of their works, when you're reading, you just come away saying, yeah, whatever, that doesn't really matter. Before I ask some of my specific questions, I want to make sure I understand what's his sort of operating assumptions about the individual? Like, if we have to draw out a Rawlsian schematic of what a human being is, mm-hmm. what features are going to be included?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that question probably matters before we get to any of the other stuff.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. For a lot of different reasons. I mean, obviously, for one thing, your account of what human beings are like is going to play an incredibly influential role in any kind of political theorizing about politics. And yeah. I also think it gets at an important methodological aspect of the theory itself that's important to its appreciation. So I think the methodological thing is that Rawls is trying to build... His method is a kind of a moral epistemology called constructivism. That is a theory that is kind of inspired by Kant, although it's quite distinct from Kantian moral theory proper. And then the idea is that you can try to see morality, moral demands, or moral principles as arising out of a procedure of construction. That's the technical philosophical way to put the point. And so and then I'll just say about the political theory. And so the goal really is, this is the way that I teach it in class. Like, I could start from really controversial moral principles that I think are true. Like, I believe that human beings are made in the image of God, and then the doctrine of original sin and all that, and I could generate a moral theory or a political theory or whatever. That's like my all things considered view about things. If you are not a Christian and do not accept those assumptions, then there's just no proceeding in that conversation, right? I've started with principles that you're going to reject right from the beginning. So part of the aim is addressing that methodological challenge of trying to bridge disagreement. So Rawls is going to try to start with moral principles that are relatively uncontroversial, that are widely accepted by all. And by starting from those principles to try to see how far we can get in terms of coming to conclusions that we can all accept. Or part of it might be like you and I might agree on some premise, but we might agree on it for entirely different reasons. So let's say you believe that human beings have dignity, you know, because you're a Buddhist. And I believe that human beings have dignity because I'm a Christian, right? And so we might have wildly different reasons, but like insofar as we agree on that shared premise, maybe we can build something out of that and arrive at some conclusion that's useful and insightful for us, even though we start from different places. So all of which is to say that when Rawls thinks about human beings as individuals, he's trying to offer a pretty minimal kind of understanding of what they are. Again, because he's trying to start from premises that are as uncontroversial as possible. I actually think the most important premise in the theory actually isn't the account of persons. It's something else that maybe we can get to later. But then I'll say, technically speaking, what he says about persons is just this. They're characterized by what Rawls calls the two moral powers, and which he describes as there being rational and there being reasonable. And both of those are technical philosophical words for Rawls. That gets at right. That thing that you said earlier. He's really good at coining concepts. So the thing that's misleading about them is that they don't sound like technical philosophical concepts, and Rawls is using them in very idiosyncratic specific ways. But to be rational in Rawls' sense is to have some individual conception of the good life, like some conception that you have that you want to pursue, and you'll be rational, like you'll choose the most efficient means to satisfy those ends.
Right, so Scientologists can be rational
in that
within
sense.
The stuff that they believe.
Yes.
Right, it is consistent with their worldview, to use the word that drives Nathan Gilmore into a rage.
Yeah. Sure. Worldview?
Worldview. Not Scientologist. Worldview.
Yeah, I'm with Nathan on that, I think, but maybe for different reasons. But yeah, it's just having a conception of the good, what it is. So human beings have conceptions of the good for our own life, and we try to pursue them. And then reasonable, in Rawls' sense, though, is the idea that... But we realize that we're all going to do better if we live in a political society together, and that's going to generate certain kinds of rules that we need to abide by. And so being reasonable in Rawls' sense is to have a sense of justice, like being willing to constrain our pursuit of the good on the basis of principles of fair cooperation that are going to make life better for all of us. So I'd say that's what he assumes about human beings.
Yeah, which I like how you've actually teed that up into one of my big questions.
Oh, good.
Because by explaining it that way, what you've done is separate justice from the good, which is going to include morality.
Yes. Right?
So what he's done is he's functionally disagreed with Plato and disagreed with much of the Western tradition and said, yeah, these are actually two different things, right? They're that are not, at least in any way that matters, connected to each other.
So that's a great question and a great observation. It gets at something that I think is central to the theory, though often misunderstood. And so the idea that you just expressed, to use the Rawlsian language, is that Rawls thinks that the right is prior to the good. And then that phrase is often misunderstood. But the idea is that principles of justice, principles of fair cooperation between persons, take precedence over individual conceptions of the good. And again, that's a little bit for methodological reasons, because if a theory of justice were rooted in any individual conception of the good life, say Christian or Buddhist or Roman Catholic or secular humanist, then it couldn't be the object of agreement and consensus amongst people living in diverse societies. You can take that idea, though, that the right is prior to the good in a deeper sense for Rawls, that it is conceptually prior to theories of the good, that theories of the good are conceptually follow theories of right behavior. That's also true of Rawls. That's maybe a sense of Rawls that I would actually want to resist myself. But Rawls himself probably thinks that.
Yeah, and I'll encourage listeners to go back and listen to the interview we did with Jonathan Lehman on his book Political Church. I think we spend probably a third of that interview talking about that very topic.
Yeah, I was trying to get into the weeds a little bit with Jonathan.
Yeah, he's the guy to get into it with. He knows this stuff backward and forward. But it still it comes up pretty clearly in Justice is Fairness. Yeah. So I wanted to make sure that we included it. Anything else on that? Otherwise, I'll move on to my next round of questions.
Well, yeah, but you're probably going to want to come back to that point and make hay.
We could talk about that one all day. What Rawls is basically doing is giving his own definition of the good and saying mine wins, right? He doesn't want to call it that because then he gets caught in this division that he's made. But functionally, what he's doing is declaring sort of de facto his perspective on justice to be the winner. He's not really willing to send that into the into that arena of competing goods.
Yeah, so I think there's a way that is true, but I think it's a way that's less objectionable than the way that you want to put the point. And I think that this point is so central and important and gets at the root of a lot of conservative discontent with Rawls specifically and with the liberal political order in general. And it's an attitude that is increasingly expressed amongst conservative intellectuals and conservative government officials. It's an attitude that forms the basis of that sort of new development in conservative thought that I alluded to earlier, which has come to be called national conservatism, that sees the liberal political order as being embedded with this thick, liberal, individualistic conception of the good life that prizes individual autonomy amongst all others, and wants to illuminate that point to poke at the pretense that the liberal polity is a kind of a neutral playing ground amongst different competing conceptions of the good, right? And so all of these conservative political theorists, from Dineen to these rising figures in the national conservatism movement.
I don't know how to say some of their names either.
Well, so Hazzoni, Yoram, right. Hazzoni, Sarabi, all of the like intellectual figures are increasingly like putting their point on this and being like, see, liberalism and liberal political institutions pretend to neutrality when in fact they're really embedded in this thick picture of human flourishing that prizes individual autonomy that is hostile to a lot of different things.
Right, and I wouldn't want to say it exactly that way about Rawls, because he is not a libertarian. One of the when we get into national conservatism, that's one of the things that we'll talk about is they want to turn their guns on both progressives and libertarians.
Yes.
And Rawls is very much not. In fact, he explicitly the position that he responds to most in this book is libertarianism. He deals a little bit with utilitarianism, although he tends to lump them in with the libertarians. But he is only on the progressive side of the what's receiving the fire from these national mm-hmm. conservatives.
And then I would just say to that, all of that, those worries are very, very subtle. I think that there's a way in which the worries are true. I think there's a way in which the worries aren't true. And then I guess I would just say this. Like, I mean, Rawls is a liberal is certainly a liberal in his heart. Rawls could give an argument in favor of, like, that kind of conception, liberal conception of the good, if he wanted to. It's just like he's not interested in doing that in this book. Because, again, he's trying to start from starting places that are meant to be widely shared. And then the deepest intuition of the theory isn't, like, this conception of persons. The deepest intuition in the theory is this idea that justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view, which is Rawls's language. And so this is the idea that there are a lot of facts about human beings that are really significant in one way, but actually not significant in another way. So, like, political institutions shouldn't treat black people differently than white people. Right? Why? Because while race and ethnicity in some ways is a really, really significant thing about people, in another kind of a way, from the perspective of justice, it isn't. It's like an arbitrary difference. It doesn't have significance. This is just the idea that, you know, that you see when you go to the courthouse and you see the statue of blind lady justice, right? She's making her decisions on the by ignoring facts about us that are morally insignificant. Like race and gender and age and where you're from, whether you're rich or whether you're poor. And this is just a pretty basic idea of liberal equality that like not everybody shares, right? So racists don't share that view. They don't think that ethnicity is morally arbitrary But almost everybody shares that view.
Right. Well, and I'm not completely sure Rawls would share that view fully, since presumably he would have supported something like affirmative action programs. So some room for treating people differently race.
That's exactly right. But you can think of that as a mechanism of non-ideal justice. And so living in a world with certain kind of inequalities, it makes sense to create government programs that recognize certain aspects of ourselves in order to address historical injustices. And it makes sense, for example, that you have social security programs that are obviously treating older Americans differently than younger Americans, right, but it's doing so in neutral ways, as it were. So all of that is obviously true, but like the deeper moral truth is that we're equal.
Well, the deeper moral truth, I think, if I'm understanding this right, is that government is to be an equalizer, because there are ways in which we are not equal.
Well, no, so I would say that government aims at treating people equally. That what government is society is a system of fair cooperation. It generates social cooperation, generates benefits and burdens that help everyone. But then it's a question of, well, what are these fair terms of cooperation? And that's exactly what the theory is trying to spell out. So it's about treating people fairly or equally, as it were, but not equalizing, actually.
Not fully equalizing. So he does specifically reject communism. But there is still an equalizing element here, and it we should get to this, I guess. Anything else before we?
Well, I was just going to say to that worry. To me, the big point that Rawls is getting at is that there's a certain kind of standard or criteria of fairness or equal treatment under law that Rawls is getting at. That's really what the priority of the right over the good is about. And yeah, that's true. That actually presupposes a kind of a conception of the good, namely that human beings have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect. And not everybody believes that. Racists don't believe that. But everyone else believes that. And so Rawls isn't going to like defend that, but he's like, hey, you know, we all agree with this, right? I mean, we can set aside racists, but the rest of us agree with that. And if we agree with that, then we can build a theory from that. There's no point in trying to defend that. And so when people push back on that particular kind of a point, like, you can do that, but then you have to reject that fundamental liberal idea that human beings have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect.
And, well, you could agree with that, but disagree with the way he wants to treat people with respect, right? You could disagree with his definition of that and say, yeah, people all have a basic dignity and people all should be treated equally. But I disagree with what you mean by treated equally.
Sure. So you could dicker about like what exactly that means in practice, but. I think the amount of arguing that you could have about the scope of argument that you could have about that isn't as elastic as a lot of conservatives actually want to think. So, like, if you think that we should tolerate, if you think that that Muslims should have freedom of religion, which presumably you think, and which sure. presumably Patrick Deneen thinks, and presumably Hazzoni thinks. I think it becomes very difficult to explain why, for example, homosexual persons shouldn't have the right to get married.
Hmm.
Like, I think those cases are in the same boat. They're in the same bucket. And you got to take them all or you can reject them. And so if you're really down on same-sex marriage, then that's fine. You can do that. But then you have to be like, you're giving up on liberalism. You have to get rid of all the ideas in the liberal pod.
Well, or you're, again, it is possible to say marriage and religion aren't the same thing, right? You can believe one and have other thoughts about the other as well.
That's right, but that's where I think that elasticity of that kind of claim, it's not as elastic as people would like to think. Because
to go back to the Rawls point, again, everyone is equal. Most of the major even spectrums within liberalism agree on that. But if you put a libertarian and a communist in the same room together, they both believe everyone should be treated equally by the government.
Well, communists...
But they're going to have radically different interpretations of that. Right? It's not enough to say, look, you guys both agree on a fundamental equality. That's not actually going to get you anywhere.
Well, communists aren't liberals for one thing.
Yeah, we had that discussion in our communism episodes.
I mean, they really aren't. There certainly is a kind of equality that they're trying to achieve, but they're going to want to say that liberal political ideology, I mean, that's just an ideology that's created by the bourgeoisie to manipulate the masses. But they might
even both agree on what it looks like in practice, right? They might even be able to agree, yeah, it looks like everyone has sufficient food to eat, and you know, maximum number of people have sufficient food to eat, maximum number of people have sufficient access to healthcare, maximum number of people, all of these other things that they might agree on what the picture of the good life functionally is. But again, there's still such a divide between the two.
Yeah, okay. Well, So you could say this. So, like, what is the conception of equality that's going to countenance freedom of conscience and religious liberties, under which being a gay person and wanting to pursue a particular kind of conception of the good in that way is going to be different, right?
Wait, say that again.
What's the conception of religious liberty or liberty of conscience that's going to be like, yeah, well, religious liberty is one thing, but the right of gay people to pursue their own conception of the good as they see fit, that actually doesn't count.
Okay, so we're going back to the previous example.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Well, again, without getting into too much down the rabbit trail, I think it's certainly possible to say, I believe the government ought to respect people's freedom of religion, and I believe that marriage is a specific institution with specific structures and forms that the government has no right to tinker with. I don't see those as being incompatible statements. But in either case, you're still taking a vision of the good, right? You're still, whichever side of that argument you're taking, you're still taking a vision of the good, right?
Yeah, no. So, and I totally agree with you on that. I guess my point is that for a certain kind of conservative, yeah, so it's right. Rawls is committed to a certain kind of liberal conception of the good, namely that people have a certain kind of dignity that deserves respect. And, like, you could be like, I reject that. But then, you know, then you're a racist.
Well, you can reject his definitions of dignity and respect. I mean, you can say, yeah, you are right. People have dignity and respect, but it's not what Rawls says it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, so that's right. But then, and then I'm going to want to argue that, like, it just becomes really difficult to discriminate between those cases. Sarabi, the thing that motivates the Frenchism article, I mean, this is stuff that we're going to talk about. The thing that motivates a very famous thing that he wrote was this story about a transgender person reading books to kids at a public library.
Right.
Which for him, like, just crossed some kind of crazy line. And it just becomes difficult to me, I think, to discriminate between, like, well, what's... I don't even know what he wants to do about that. Like, does he want to make it illegal for transgender people to, like, be in the presence of children or to read books publicly? Or, like, I don't even know what he wants to do.
Right.
But, like, it becomes difficult to be like, yeah, we can't have that, but it's okay for Muslims to worship in mosques. To me, it's interesting that so many of those people on that national conservatism movement are Roman Catholics. And I think that is intellectually interesting.
Sure. Well, anything else? Otherwise, I have a couple of other questions. We're only going to scratch the surface of this book.
Yeah.
And this is Rawls's short book,
yeah.
So, you know. So the vehicle, the mechanism that he has to explore this is the veil of ignorance,
yeah.
Right? The original position. We talked about this in the Rawls episode. The idea is... Everyone, we have this debate, and Rawls is very clear. This is an imaginary situation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't expect this to actually happen, but we have this imagined debate between a representative of every faction in society.
Mm-hmm.
But we strip them of their knowledge of which factions they represent,
mm-hmm.
They go in and they try to decide what form of political structures are ideal, and because none of and operating under rules that are provided to them using different options that are provided to him by all of us who are kind of watching this debate as kind of the umpires of the debate, they then come up with the political structures that will most advantage whichever group of people they see as being least advantaged in society, because they think that might be the people they're representing. Right there, they want to get the political system that is best if you're the person representing kind of the bottom tier of society.
Yeah, so that's right. So the veil of ignorance represents that idea that I mentioned earlier, that justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view. And it represents that idea in the theory by stripping from view from individuals all of the facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view. So they don't know if they're a man or a woman, rich or poor, if they went to Harvard or the local community college. And then those factors can't play a role then in the selection of the theory.
And I feel like the sort of easy pot shot to take here is, well, I might be the one who's representing the, you know, several hundred thousand infants who are executed by their mothers every
mm-hmm.
year. So perhaps abortion ought to be taken off the table, right? Whatever society we come up with. I think that's kind of the easy shot to take. I assume there's some kind of standard Rawlsian response.
Well, I mean, the debate there is that who gets represented, you know? And so
right.
The pushback is, well, no, because they're not persons.
Well, Rawls is not to this specifically, but Rawls's attitude seems to be, look, if you're concerned about representation, just give them a representative, right? If someone thinks they are not genuinely represented, give them a person, tell them that's who they represent.
That's right, but like, you only represent people. I mean, we're not going to represent. Here's an interesting debate. Like, why shouldn't we include animals? And then, or plants. We're not, I mean, we're obviously not going to include plants. Why aren't we going to include plants? Well, they're not persons. This is a theory of justice for social cooperation between people. And then, I mean, I think.
Speciesist.
Well, yeah. That's right. Sure. And people might push back against that, but anyways. And then the argument is, yeah, and, you know, I don't think the unborn are persons. Or that's really right. complicated. But, you know, and right. that goes back to the two moral powers. I mean, they don't have the two moral powers. Yeah, so that's right.
Right. Yeah, so like I said, I thought that was sort of the easy one. But I think it gets a little more complicated when he starts talking about, all right, well, what systems will they be debating? And he has his list of, I think it's five kind of systems that he sees in the world that are kind of the major contenders. But then he does say, look, here are the other, you know, if there is something that you sketched out on a bar napkin when you were in grad school, throw it into the mix, right? Throw it into consideration. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that becomes very difficult, especially in terms that he sets up. What happens when I come along and say, look, here's my argument for why we should go back to feudalism, right? And this is really what's best for the least advantaged in society. Because they're, and then make all of the arguments that go into that.
So what exactly is the argument in favor of that feudalism is good for everybody?
Oh, rigid legal protections for the poorest bottom classes of society. No slavery whatsoever. For the people who hate capitalism, there's not much of capitalism around. If you are the sort of person who is likely to rise through the ranks in a capitalist society, there are merchant classes available to you, and there's, of course, always the church as sort of the place where the best and the brightest have the opportunity to flourish. I mean, you could make all kinds of arguments for it. But again, all of those things are assuming that you have some vision of the good that you want to accomplish. Right. At the end of the day, you still have to decide when we say what's best for the least advantaged. You have to have some idea of what's best in mind.
Well, so again, like I think that's right, but I think that notion of what's so there is a notion of what's best, but I think that notion of what's best is so minimal as to be uncontroversial to virtually anyone. Like, if you didn't know whether you were a lord or a serf, and actually the odds of you being a lord are basically, like...
Oh, yeah. Very, very low.
Would you...
But you could... Again, given that the kind of legal status of serfs is not inconsiderable... Right now, again, what that looks like in, you know, sort of historical reality, radically different question, right? Radically, radically different question. But Rawls says we don't take these things based on their historical reality. We take them based on their sort of theoretical ideals, right? So as an ideal system, is it really that much worse than property-owning democracy or socialism?
I mean, of course it is. Like, that's crazy. I mean, because you get legal protection. I mean... The kinds of legal protections, like, I don't know that we should celebrate feudal society as being this great example of equal treatment under the law. But even if it were, you get that in property-owning democracy, or, I mean, in the kind of arrangement that Rawls wants to defend, and you get the fact that you're not a serf. So, like, isn't that better? Wouldn't you rather be... living in a modern society with the freedom to pursue, and you don't know what your religious convictions are, is the other thing. Like, if you're a serf and you're Protestant and you're living under a Roman Catholic lord, God help you, you know?
Well, again, we're working with the ideal circumstances here, right? So these are systems at their best. And again, I think that's where it becomes tricky because, to judge this, we still have to bring in, some kind of criteria of judgment, and the gut reaction of, oh, that sounds terrible, I agree with that, but again, that's because I have a view of what the best is, right? I have a view of the good kind of lifestyle, and it doesn't conform to that. But now I'm no longer doing this right and the good anymore. I'm now judging this based on this vision of the good that I've got.
Yeah, no, that's right. So again, as I said earlier, like Rawls, in fact, has a conception of the good.
And functionally, the neutral arbiters also have to have a vision of the good.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make something out of nothing. If you want a moral theory, you have to start from moral presuppositions. It's just that the moral presuppositions that Rawls is starting with are meant to be general and uncontroversial so as to win the widest level of participation in the theory.
Which then either says they're not really neutral, right? They're what they really are, what Rawls really wants them to be, is people who agree with him, again, on this vision of the good. Or if they are neutral, then, I mean, there's no guarantee. Like, if we have, you know, robots who are somehow neutrally programmed, if such a thing were possible, that are weighing all of these different systems against each other, and we don't give them some kind of final, like, picture of what things should look like, I mean, who knows what we're going to get?
Well, so again, of course it's not neutral. Of course it's rooted in conceptions of the good. But the only people who are going to be like, the only people, as Rawls constructs the theory, the only people who are really going to be left out in the cold are like people who deny that human beings have a basic kind of dignity and equality, which is to say racists. So if you are a racist, then you would be like, yeah, I'm not on board with this. And Rawls would be like, yeah, you know what? I didn't give an argument defending my moral presuppositions. I could do that. So there's nothing in my theory there's no bait in my theory for you to buy onto. So it's true, you can reject my theory, but hey, you're a racist.
Right, and see, I do think it's possible to disagree with Rawls without being a racist.
Right, but now you got to vindicate that. So again, the idea is Rawls thinks that...
So Rawls doesn't have to vindicate his political positions, but if I disagree with him, I do have to vindicate mine.
No, Coyle, he's just sort of like, hey, don't you think this is true? That justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view? Don't you think it's true that people have a basic kind of dignity and equality? And they should be free to pursue their own form of the good without interference so long as they're not hurting other people? Don't you think that's true?
And I can say, well, when you say dignity, give that word some content, and I can tell you whether or not I agree with it.
Yeah,
And when you say arbitrary from a moral point of view, I can say, well, why don't you tell me what you mean by arbitrary and by a moral point of view?
Yeah, and so he can do that and be like, well, I mean, do you think that Muslim people, you're not a Muslim, do you think that they deserve religious toleration to worship as they see fit?
Within certain bounds, sure.
Sure.
So when we start talking about the caliphate and the Muslim views of, you know, political theory, I might say, not so much.
No, that's right. And then Rawls can be like, yes, exactly. Because they're going to be certain.
And I'm going to say the Christian view should win there.
I'm sorry, what?
And I'll say, yeah, the Christian view should win there.
And then he would say, well, wait a second. Isn't that exactly what the Muslim is going to say, right? The Muslim is going to be like, hey, no, this picture of political morality is correct, and we want to impose that on everybody. And then Rawls is going to be like, liberals want to resist that. Why?
Rawls is going to say the liberal view is correct, and we want to impose that on everybody. But he's not going to come right out and say that. It's just functionally what he's doing.
No, he does come out and say that. I mean, that's the very idea in which he talks about the veil of ignorance and the two moral powers and all of that. Like, that's not a secret, but he's like, you believe this, and you do
right,
believe
and,
it. Your whole point of resisting illiberal Muslims is because you're liberal in that way. So like the very drawing of that line is Rawls is like, exactly. You and I are exactly in agreement. We both believe that people have an intrinsic kind of dignity to pursue their own conception of the good as they see fit, so long as they're not impinging on the liberties of others, right? Your reason for drawing the line around a certain kind of traditionalist Islamic political philosophy that just affirms Rawls's point. He's like, exactly, you and I agree.
I mean, we may agree on that specific line that it ought to be drawn, but again, that doesn't imply agreement as to why. It doesn't imply it may not even imply agreement as to what the nature of the line is, right? And I still wouldn't want to take that as an assumption of sort of a grander agreement over procedure and methods.
Rawls's point is
doesn't imply that the visions are in broader agreement.
So that's right, and then there's going to be a further argument. I mean, Rawls wants to be, hey, like, we agree on this, don't we? That's really, really important. Now, we might disagree as to what that means, how that works out in practice. In Rawls's theory, I mean, there's a certain kind of, Rawls thinks that there's a certain kind of wiggle room. He wouldn't want to say that, he would draw the line at, for example, gay marriage equality. Like, he's like, that's not something that we can disagree about. But it's not like he's just going to assert that. He's going to give an argument, right? And again, the basic point is, if you think that people have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect, then you also got to believe this other thing. So there's an argument for that, right? It's not just asserting that. But, like, you're right. This, to me, is, like, the most important thing that I think people get wrong about Rawls, which is why I'm really glad that, like, we're talking about it. Yeah, like, Rawls, in fact, he's a liberal. But then his point is, you probably are too, but you're just being inconsistent. And now let me explain to you why. And so, like, you can reject his starting point, but then, like, you got to reject, you got to reject the core of what it is to be politically liberal. Which none of these people really want to do.
I think I'm fine with rejecting the core. As said in our liberalism episode, I'm fine with rejecting the core of what it is to be politically liberal. But that doesn't negate the places where I'm going to agree with liberals, right? It doesn't negate that I still believe in, you know, rights to pick on one of the things that's at the core of what it is.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Like, you can't.
Sure, I can't.
You're saying
there's no consistently Christian way to believe in rights that is unconnected from liberalism. It was not possible to believe in rights prior to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. That's crazy. Even aside from whether or not that's historically accurate, like, of course there are.
But every time you commit yourself to any kind of rights talk, you're committing yourself to a liberal position.
I might be committing myself to a position that a liberal agrees with, but it's not the same thing as saying it's a liberal position.
That's fine. Tell me exactly what you're agreeing to, and only in exactly what you're agreeing to.
All right. Well, let's say we both agree on the right to property, right? Let's pick a sort of liberal right that's, you know, historically grounded. I know you have a deadline, so we'll have to wrap this up. So I might say, hey, there's a right to property because, you know, as a Christian, I can say because God is sovereign. God created everything. God sets up these rules, establishes, you know, do not steal, and, you know, distributes goods as he sees fit and so on. Or I could say, well, actually, I'm a liberal, and I believe kind of core fundamental aspects of what it is to be human, and one of those things is the right to property, and I can go back and I can justify that from Thomas Hobbes's State of Nature. Now, functionally, in practice, we might both agree on what law the U.S. government should pass that's going to protect that right of property. We might disagree, but we could conceivably agree from those two different beginning positions, and neither of us is necessarily being inconsistent. We're both being rational, right, even if we're not completely agreeing on our sort of background reasons for it.
So I would want to poke on this Christian conception of property that you're getting at. And my point in poking at it is that under that conception of property in some ways actually I think is a bad example. But
pick life, pick liberty, pick one of the big three. I don't care, right? Whatever one.
Well, yeah, so pick religious freedom. So, like, what's behind your conception of religious liberty?
So, behind my conception of I could speak about that as a Christian.
Yeah, so speak about it as a Christian.
Sure. So I could talk about the nature of how we see the gospel being spread in the New Testament, right? Where the apostles go out and preach, and people come and believe or they don't. At no point do they ever apply to the government for compulsion, even when government figures are converted. At no point is there any going to Caesar and saying, hey, why don't you go and compel people to, mm-hmm. to come in? Instead, there seems to be the understanding that we are going to be living in societies where we are the minority and where we do not have the power of the state at our disposal. That's one way off the top of my head I would justify that as a Christian. I would say, look, this is the opposite of religious liberty is religious freedom politically is not something we are ever told to go out and make happen.
So a couple points there, and then the wider point that I'm going to get at is, if you poke at your Christian vindication of the idea of religious liberties, eventually you're going to get at a distinctively liberal idea that human beings have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect. And then that's it. And then, as you said earlier, I actually think that historically speaking, at the rise of liberal political theory in the 16th and 17th centuries, that if you trace it back far enough, I think that idea is a distinctively Christian idea. But set that aside. I don't know if you...
Oh, sure. The Christian influences on liberalism are...
Yeah, okay.
Obviously,
but,
yeah.
But my point is that, like, you can try to craft your story, as you just did, so as to avoid appealing to any distinctively liberal ideals. But,
no,
like...
because that was the challenge, right?
But I think that's in bad faith. Your argument was basically, hey, well, Scripture never tells us to go out and compel people, so we shouldn't do it. But like, that's obviously a facetious argument. I mean, Scripture doesn't... You can't take the absence of Scripture not saying something as evidence that you shouldn't do it. Right?
Sorry, I'm thinking through that. I think so. Well, and then the positive side of that is, how are we told to spread the gospel? Again, it's through preaching and evangelism,
mm-hmm.
right? It's through the Great Commission. It's not through government power.
That's right. But again, you can't.
I want to hear you say no, Ed. It is through government power. Come on, Ed. Let's hear it.
Well, no. I mean, of course, I don't believe that, right? Because I'm a liberal.
Sure.
And
sure.
I'm not trying to pretend that I'm. But I'm not a liberal. But, like, again, it's worth inspecting the view that you're getting at, and, like, how thin it is. It just, well, Scripture doesn't tell us to. Well, why do you think that is? Let's poke on that a little bit. And you're never going to get an interesting answer to that question without getting to something like that most fundamental idea that human beings are made in the image of God.
So, well,
Christian liberal defense of religious toleration is so thin and uncompelling, and you don't even really believe that.
But let's say we're back to the image of God in Christians. Okay, fine. That's not liberal. That's Christian.
So right?
that is something Rawls is going to say. Hey, that's your vision of the good. That's not the right. You don't get to bring that into the arena.
But again, right? for the purposes of the theory, Rawls believes that, say, because he's a Kantian, and you believe that, say, because you're a Christian. And, like, that's fine. We don't need to answer that question. We all agree on that point. Like, Rawls, in a certain kind of way, isn't trying to convince you of that fundamental starting point. And that's because he doesn't have to. You already believe it. And then the whole argument is just trying to show that, hey, actually, if you believe this thing, you have to be committed to all this other stuff. But and like, you could try to resist that if you wanted to. But that's a very different kind of an argument than saying, oh, he's importing some kind of surreptitious liberal theory. Like, no, you actually believe that. That's why the theory is so technically, aesthetically even interesting to political theorists. It's because the argument is so clever. He's like starting with what everybody believes and then just showing that if you believe it, you should be like an incredibly progressive person.
Right. And I'm hesitant to say that everybody believes it, in part because I'm not sure that's true. And the reasons for believing it are different, then how you want to interpret it and how you want to apply it might reasonably be very different than what a progressive liberal might.
So again,
the fact that we agree on this one point, even if we actually agree there, doesn't imply really anything, I think, that Rawls wants it to imply.
So then again, you get to the other series of arguments, I would say. But then note that, like, you've given up on the objection that you were making earlier, which is namely, well, Rawls has this hidden conception of the good. Like, no, it's not a hidden conception of the good. It's, like, right there from the first page. And his point is you believe that, too. And then, so you're right, you could try to disagree, but then you have to engage in the argument. And the objection that you were raising earlier, like, that's the wrong objection to make. And that is what, like, a certain kind of conservative political theorist, they always make that objection. But, like, that's the wrong... There are other objections you can make. That's not the right objection. So, like, you have to give up on that.
So the "we don't actually agree" isn't the right objection.
The objection... It's wrong to say, oh, Rawls is surreptitiously importing some liberal conception of the good. No, he's not surreptitiously importing that at all. That's explicit. And then the point is, you believe that too.
Well, I think that objection comes from him saying over and over and over, we're not allowed to use our vision of the good. Right? I mean, that objection is not inconsistent with his methodology.
Well, that's a misunderstanding of the methodology then.
I mean, it's his claim that we should separate the right from the good. Again, to say what you're saying another way, what he's really saying is we should separate this good from all of those other goods.
It's a difference between drawing on a conception of the good in the business of theory building and drawing on a conception of the good in an actual political process. But again, insofar as you think that Muslim people deserve religious liberties, you actually think that the right is prior to the good too. Because otherwise you'd be like, no, we can't have that. Those people are wrong. We're right. The Christian conception of the good is right. Therefore, we can't have religious liberties. That's what it really is to think that the good is prior to the right. But nobody believes that, except for crazy people. Maybe that's a good place to stop.
Yeah, well, again, that's a longer conversation. I feel like we've done a Freedom of Religion episode, but it's been a while.
No,
so
this is...
off the top of my head. If we haven't, we should.
Yeah, I mean, this gets at something fundamental that I think a mistake that certain kinds of conservative critics of liberalism make all the time. Like, there are arguments you can kind of make, but this is the wrong argument to make. But anyways, so I will tell everybody that you have been listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast, which is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. If you want to reach out to us, you can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Is that right? Anyways, go to our Facebook page is the answer to that question. And as always, let me remind everybody to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.